So today's topic is broken engagements and halacha. We're going to discuss over the next two sessions, hopefully, the subject of broken engagement cases and also canceled invitations. Canceled invitations relates to other types of cancellation issues as well. When people schedule a wedding, speaking of broken engagements, and the wedding has to be canceled, or say a caterer suddenly becomes unavailable. There were incidents in Israel where, based on an outbreak of terrorism or war, there were certain regions where it became unsafe for people to travel. So if they had booked wedding halls for a simcha at that moment in time, they needed to cancel. And the question is, who should bear the loss of the cancellation of the caterer, of the hall, of the band, etc., etc.? So that's why it's good as a starting point for these types of discussions to speak about a relatively common phenomenon, which often leads to Beis Din filings, and that is the phenomenon of broken engagements. So it's known that Batei Din deal with divorces. Divorces, certainly we all understand that a Jewish couple gets divorced, they have to do a get, and the Beis Din gets involved, we do the get. Sometimes we adjudicate other aspects of the divorce. That's all relatively standard. But sometimes a couple will decide to break up before there's a need for a get, namely after the shiduchin, after the engagement. There are really three stages to a marital journey. One is the first is the shiduchin, the engagement. The second is the erusin, the betrothal. And the third is the nisuin, the marriage. Now, we often can't really tell the difference so much between the erusin and the nisuin because they happen right next to each other. The erusin is when the chassan gives the kala the ring and says, Harayat mekudeshesli, you're hereby betrothed to me, and in front of two witnesses. That's the erusin. The nisuin is when the husband brings, the chassan brings the kala into his domain. That occurs through a combination of factors, and mostly through the chuppah. They stand underneath the chuppah, the wedding canopy, and then when he brings the kala into the yichud room. So those are the aspects of the nisuin. And of course, we do the erusin, the nisuin, basically back-to-back. So it used to be, if you look in some of the classical sources, that it was also not such an unusual phenomenon that somebody would want to break up the marriage between the erusin and the nisuin. The only thing is that if you would back down from a marriage between the erusin and the nisuin, that would require a get, because once the kiddushin, the erusin, has taken place, then the woman is already considered to be an eshesish. She's considered to be married to the chassan. So even if one of them would decide to back out between the erusin and the nisuin, it would require a get, but this happened anyway. So they'd say, okay, so we need a get, but it's still sometimes they just wouldn't want to go through with it because there would be a waiting period. Like now we have the waiting period between the engagement and the kiddushin / nisuin. So we know about that waiting period, but the Gemara talks about what used to be sort of a standard 12-month waiting period between the erusin and the nisuin. And they find out things about each other sometimes during that period, or become a little bit disenchanted with each other, and you could have a breakup with the marriage. So as we'll see, when the Rambam speaks about somebody backing out, he speaks about the backing out taking place between the erusin and the nisuin, because that was typically a sizable period of time in which this could potentially occur. But we know that shiduchin, that having an engagement, is also not a newfangled like Western civilization concept, but this is something that occurred in the time of the Gemara as well. In fact, the Gemara says that asa l'kai shishav lishiduchin, you're not allowed to become betrothed. Husband and kala, now let's become betrothed to each other without there first being a shidduchin. Why is that important to be a shidduchin? The idea of shidduchin is that you want to have the two parties get to know each other just a little bit so that they can make sure that they like each other. There's a modicum of affinity that they feel towards each other. And also this runs, this is consistent with the Gemara at the beginning of the second parak of Kiddushin that says that a man is not allowed to be mekadesh a woman ad shiyarena until he sees her first, because you have to have some degree of familiarity in order to fulfill the mitzvah of what? What mitzvah is fulfilled? We ensure it gets fulfilled over the course of the marriage if the husband first looks at the wife and makes sure that she finds favor in his eyes, and presumably vice versa as well. So what is the mitzvah that is fulfilled? The Gemara says, "Ve'ahavta l'reicha kamocha," because the most profound manifestation of love and like that a person is going to have to demonstrate over the course of their lifetime is towards their spouse, because this is the person that they interact with on the most regular and frequent basis, day in and day out. You want to make sure that this is a person who's not going to present too hard a challenge in terms of fulfilling the mandate of Ve'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. If you go into marriage, this is the main person you're going to have to like and love and shower your affection upon your entire life, and you already start off not really caring for them too much. That's probably a very bad idea. So that's why it's important that there be a little bit of familiarity beforehand, and that's the idea of the engagement. So the engagement is not a foreign concept. There should be shiduchin, and then there's erisin, and then there is nisuin. So with us, when we speak about a marriage breaking up before the nisuin, we don't really speak about it realistically. In the context of a marriage break, I've never seen this happen. I don't know if any of you have ever seen this happen. Has anybody seen it happen? I've never seen a marriage breakdown between the erisin and the nisuin. That's a period of about 2 minutes right now. The husband gives the wife the ring, and then afterwards somebody's reading the ksuba. Right? And this is before they say the sherev al kasani. Look up, you have to have like a breakup of the marriage right at that moment in time as somebody is reading the chuppah, the ksuba under the chuppah. Or the rabbi is giving the speech. He's making the speech. He's saying, "Oh, I never thought that this guy would ever marry anybody. I can't believe somebody finally agreed to marry him. He's like, he has nothing going for him at all." Never thought, what am I doing? Am I crazy? You know. So I've never seen that happen. Never seen that happen. People have made speeches like that, but I've never seen like a person actually have the gumption to between the off of sure. Or day before him, 100%. But between the Aries and the Nisuin, you certainly don't see this happen. So when do we see it happen? We would see this happen most frequently between the Shiduchin and the Kiddushin. The good thing about a breakup of the match during this period of time is that it does not necessitate the giving of a get. There's no need for them giving the get. But there are other issues, namely there are monetary claims. So just like over the course of a divorce, there could be monetary claims. A person might have invested a lot of money in preparing for the wedding, and then suddenly one party backs out and they want to recover their expenses. Or they suffered a tremendous amount of embarrassment and they want to be compensated for the boshes, for the embarrassment. Or they gave gifts. Somebody, the husband gave an engagement ring and the caliber backs down. He says, "I want my engagement ring back." Or the chassan backs out and he says, "I want my engagement ring back." And the kahal says, "Well, it's bad enough that you you broke off the engagement. I have to return the engagement ring too. That's like the only thing that I have out of this. That's not right." So sometimes these issues are not so readily resolved between the parties or their parents, for that matter. Sometimes the parties would be willing to resolve the issues, but the parents are not so willing to resolve the issues, and they end up being litigated in bed. And the question is, what is the halakhic perspective towards these issues? And then we'll see how the halakhic perspective towards these issues might also have ramifications with respect to other areas of halakhic situations as well. So the starting point is we have a cryptic Gemara in Tainis. Gemara in Tainis sort of alludes to something, and it's sort of with a wink and a nod that you're supposed to understand. It's like a folktale that you're supposed to understand, like everybody knows this folktale because presumably their children, their parents told them this story when they were putting them to bed at night. But here a couple thousand years later, we look at it and we don't necessarily have the same familiarity with the story. We were hearing, I don't know, Goldilocks and the Three Bears or Little Red Riding Hood and her grandmother. We didn't hear this particular tale. So therefore, Tosfos has to fill in what this folktale is. So what is the Gemara? The Gemara says that we are zoche, that we merit to have rain, because of people who keep their word. Because keeping one's word is extremely important. Shenemar, Emes Me'aretz Titzmach, V'tzedek Mishmayim Nishkaf, Amar Rabbi Ami, Vorei Kam Gedolim Balei Emuna. Go and see how important it is to keep your word. How incredibly important it is to keep your word. Minayin Mechul De'ubor. We learn this from the story of the weasel and the pit. The chulde and the boar. You all know the story of the weasel and the pit, right? The emperor's new clothes, the weasel and the pit. Everyone knows that story? No, apparently not. So Tosfos, so ma, hamami, bechul de'ubor kach, that if we see that you place your trust or you make a promise, which is predicated upon a weasel and a pit, there is a tremendous degree of accountability. Hamami v'kadosh baruch hu alachas kama v'kama. So when you're placing your faith in a kadosh baruch hu and you are invoking the name of a kadosh baruch hu, how much more so that you shall have accountability. So what is this invocation of the weasel and the boar that produces this high degree of accountability? So Tosfos tells us this story. This is a story which is brought down in the Aruch. Pirish Mami Bechol Debor, this is source number two. Maisa Yabinara Achas. There was this young maiden, Maybe this is the early version of Little Red Riding Hood. She wanted to go, in this case, to her father's home. Okay, she's carrying a basket of food or whatever. And there is a pit in the path in front of her. She falls into the pit. Okay, the big bad pit. She falls into the big bad pit carrying her food on her way to her father's house. And comes along Prince Charming. Okay, and he says, if I am going to draw you out of this deep pit, okay, Tinasi Lee, so will you marry me? Beautiful, very romantic proposal. Here she is, she's fighting for life in the bottom of the pit, and she doesn't know if she'll ever be able to get out, and Prince Charming comes along, and he says, I will take you out of the pit, young princess, and will you marry me? Beautiful, it's just a beautiful story, just absolutely like Walt Disney material. So Amar lo hein, and she says, yes, Prince Charming, of course I'll marry you, and they ride off, and they live happily ever after, but not quite. So they take an oath that they should, because, you know, once you're going to make this commitment, so you have to solemnize it somehow, so make an oath. He's not going to marry another woman. She's not going to marry another man. They are destined for each other. When that moment comes, maybe they have to finish college first, whatever. When that moment comes, they're going to only marry each other, right? They said, who is going to be the witness? Because you need a witness for this type of a solemnization of an oath. By Sechulda Achas. And there was a weasel. A weasel, right? By Sechulda Achas. Holechas Lifnei Habor. By Pop goes the weasel. There's the weasel in front of the pit. For Amu Elu Shnayim. Ah, so they two of them said, this young man, the Prince Charming, and the young woman said, no problem. We have a pit. We have a weasel. We have two witnesses. Perfect. The pit and the weasel shall be our witnesses, because there are no human beings in sight, so you have to use the pit and the weasel. Okay? And then they went their merry way, right? But what happened afterwards? So the woman, of course, remembered her solemn oath, and she remembered her commitment, and she still preserved the romance of the moment in her heart, because she's a woman, right? You know, so therefore she still has that romantic sentiment that she's going to marry this guy. And he, of course, forgets completely about it. So she keeps her word. And he, like the next day, he's already on to the next thing. So he completely forgot about, you know, this incident. And, you know, he's saving other maidens from their distresses and so forth. And, you know, he's studying for his courses and whatever he's doing in life, learning. But he forgets about his promise. Funasa Isha Acheres, and he marries a different woman. And then what happens? Tragedy strikes. Vialda Ben, they have a boy. But then, Baskuldam and Shaptova Mace, a weasel comes along and bites their boy, and he dies. Vialdalo Ben Cheney, they have a second son. But now, full of war, what happens to the second son? He falls into a pit and dies. So you can discern a little bit of a pattern over here, right? Amar lo Ishto, so the wife of this Prince Charming said, hey, Prince, what's going on over here? Maze Hamase Shehigi Alanu. What is going on that I have a boy and then he gets bitten by a weasel, another boy, and he falls into a pit. Something suspicious is going on over here. So Shabbanandus doesn't have their other neighbors. So Niskar Hashvua. So then he remembered, oh, yeah, I took an oath that I was going to marry this damsel in distress. And he told his wife the entire incident. Amalo. So she said, okay, fine. So if I'm going to have with you a bunch of children who are just going to, you know, fall into pits and be bitten by weasels and die, I'd rather not be married to you. You keep your promise, okay? Get out. Get out of my life and go and marry her. The custom laget, so he wrote a get. This is where the get comes into play, but of course,
why
you know.
Why did he get? He had two.
Well, women, they didn't get. They were married.
They could have two wives.
But generally people didn't. Anyway, she didn't want to share. They didn't, you know, wives in general didn't want to have co-wives. And then he went and he married this other damsel. And this is how we see that even if you invoke a pit and a weasel, in terms of keeping your word, you are held accountable, and all the more so if you're going to invoke the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So from this Maaseh, we see that there is something that creates accountability when there is engagement. Because here, this wasn't Erusin, it wasn't Nisuin, it was only really Shiduchin, it was only a promise to marry, an oath, actually, to marry each other. And it created this tremendous bond, this tremendous accountability, and also led to a terrible misfortune over a person not keeping their word. So in Maseches Yevamos, towards the end of Maseches Yevamos, you have in the back, you have Nahagos Mordechai. Nahagos Mordechai quotes a Chayim HaKadmonim, an early Chayim that was imposed upon people who would get engaged, that they're not allowed to break their engagement. Meaning that this is sort of issue number one. are you allowed to break your engagement? And this is sometimes an issue that comes in front of the Beis Din as well. Somebody wants to break the engagement, the other one says, no, I'm not going to let you break the engagement. We have to come to Beis Din and discuss whether you have a right to break the engagement.
But engagement in the Gemara's time may have been the Kiddush.
No, we're talking about Shidduchin. Engagement is not the translation. Engagement is not the translation of Erisin. It's the translation of Shidduchin. Okay. I was once at a wedding, and the rabbi got up, and he said, okay, now I'm going to be Masada Kiddushin, and you should know that there are two different parts to the marriage process according to Jewish law. The first is where you're going to give the ring, and that's what we call Erisin, and that means engagement. And then afterwards it's going to be Nisun, and that means marriage. And we're looking at him sitting there and saying, no, that's not really the right translation. No. Right. So that's exactly where Tanaim fits in. So the Agos Mordechai quotes this Chayim HaKadmonim, saying that they made a Chayim, that they made a very stiff prohibition, a ban on people breaking an engagement. And in the event that you have a man and a woman engaged to each other, we call them chasen and kala, who are engaged to each other, and one of them would want to break the bond, they would have to receive the permission of 30 different rabbis from 3 different countries. Does that sound familiar? We know that Rabbeinu Yeshua made a chayim. He said a man's not allowed to marry more than one wife. We were just talking about that, right? But if he wants to marry a second wife, he can only do it if he has permission of 100 rabbis from 3 different countries. So here they made it a little lighter, because it's not a question of marrying a second wife, just breaking an engagement when you're not married to begin with. But even here, it would require the permission of 30 rabbis, unless both parties are agreeable. Meaning, if it is a mutually agreed upon breaking up of the engagement, so then you don't have to worry about the chayim. But if it's one party basically breaking it up against the will of the other party, so then that would be a violation of the chayim, and it was considered to be such a severe thing to do that the Vilna Gaon is quoted as having said, it is better once you are engaged, it is better, and you know that the person is not right for you, so it is better to get married and then to get divorced than to break up the engagement. Now, there are a lot of kashas on this particular approach. It's not the approach that I personally advocate, but there are a lot of kashas on this approach. One kasha on this approach is that we know that the Shulchan Aruch says in Eben Ezer, Siman Kuf Yates, that you're not allowed to marry a woman b'dayt l'garsha if you have in mind that you're going to divorce her afterwards. And here, that is exactly what's going on. The person would break the engagement, but in order to avoid the chayrim, they're going to get married first with the intention of giving a get to their wife. So that's already problematic. Second problem is, it's brought by some of the other meforshim, is that it'll be like a bracha batala under the chuppah, that you're having all of these brachos under the chuppah, everybody's getting called up for this bracha and so forth, and that bracha and the other bracha, and the chasen and kala know, at least one of them knows, that this marriage is going to be broken up immediately after it takes place with the giving of a get. So therefore, that's a problem. The third problem is that it's possible that you're creating all kinds of other difficulties that wouldn't have existed before, namely that the woman now, by receiving a get, is not going to be able to marry a kohen. Well, if there only would have been a broken engagement, she could still marry a kohen. Number four, you're going to have the problem that who knows if the guy's actually going to give a get. Maybe you're going to create a situation where, because he dislikes her so much, he'll say, okay, it was bad enough that I had to go and marry her, but now I don't want to give her a get because I want to make her life miserable forever. So there are all kinds of pitfalls and problems that could be created. So Lemaise, even though I can't say this, that this is a universal sentiment, but Lemaise, I think that by and large, most of the bunny would say this is not something that we advocate nowadays. But it's also tied in to the idea of the Tanoim. Some say that this whole Chayim HaKadmonim goes together with what's called a Knas. That's referred to by Tosfos. That's source number 3 over here in the materials. Tosfos refers to a common practice of imposing a Knas upon an individual who would break off an engagement. Okay, normally, let's say it would be the chasen would break off the engagement, and then the kala would suffer terrible distress. So we have a general principle that if a person takes upon themselves that if a certain event occurs, then they're going to pay a penalty, that commitment is not, generally speaking, legally or halachically binding. Why is that? Because it is considered to be an asmachta. An asmachta is any kind of conditional obligation where a person does not really expect that the condition is ever going to take place. That's an asmachta, and it's generally not binding. So Tosfos asks, why is it that when people enter into this knas, when they make shidduchim, when they get engaged, that in the event that the engagement is going to be broken off, we do enforce this knas. Take a look at Tosfos. Miu knas daf samach vav min alin in Baba Metzia. Miu knas she osim b'vashas shidduchim. It's a knas that's done at the time of the shidduchim. In other words, it could be that this was part and parcel of what was done. That this was, that there was part of this chayim idea of the engagement was that they imposed a very solemn knas upon anybody who would break off the engagement. So he says, why is that good? The Gemara indicates that it's only considered to be binding when a person undertakes an esmachta obligation if they do it in front of the CRC. If they do it in front of a Bezdin Chashuv, they do it in front of a very important rabbinical court. CRC, Bezdin of America, a very chashuv rabbinical court. However, here, people enter into the Tanayim ceremony. They'll do it at L'chaim. People will come. They'll have, you know, a little bit of cake, and they'll have some conversation, and they'll be drinking some schnapps or whatever they're doing. But there's no Bezdin Chashuv over there. And yet, nonetheless, we consider this to be binding. And why is that? So he says, because everybody does it. So Tosfos seems to give the answer that once this is a minhag, that this is a custom that was adopted by all of society, so that causes it to be binding in the sense that if everyone does it, you have a higher level of gemiras das. You have a higher level of commitment. That's answer number one. Just like situmta is not generally, would not be a kinyan according to halacha, but the Gemara says that if you have, what is situmta? I don't know, you put some sort of a mark on a wine barrel indicating that it's been transferred. It could be a handshake. It's just something that counts as a binding acquisition for the general world based on custom, even though the halacha doesn't say anything about situmta in terms of kesef or meshicha. It's not, you know, a standard halakha kinyan, but nonetheless, it's considered to be binding because the whole world relies upon it, okay? It's a kanya. The oath, and then Tosfos gives a second explanation. What's the second explanation? Second explanation is, because you're causing embarrassment to the other party, and it is a very sad thing. It's a very sad thing. Sometimes a party breaks off an engagement, they don't want to cause the embarrassment, but they also don't want to go through with the wedding, so it's very, very hard. But there is, objectively speaking, there is embarrassment that is caused, and therefore, because that there is actual damage that is inflicted, so the asmata obligation is not considered to be unreasonable. So the question is, do I need both answers of Tosfos? Some say, I need both answers of Tosfos, because in order for somebody to really be chayiv for boshes, for causing somebody else embarrassment, you need kavana, levayish. That's a din right out of Gemara and Baba Kama. You need to have the intention to have degraded and to have embarrassed somebody. But in a broken engagement, the intention is just to get out of the engagement. It's not to embarrass or degrade the other individual. So therefore, strictly speaking, it would not have been payable on that basis. But because of the fact that, number one, there is objective boshes, number two, there is a minhag that this is done, so that combination of factors, says Tosfos, is sufficient to trigger the paying of the knas. And sometimes there would be a name for the knas that they would say, okay, in the event of the breaking up of the engagement, so let's say the chassid would break up the engagement, he would have to pay 1,000 rubles to the kallah, something like that. The standard, actually, that was generally used was not a specific amount of 1,000 rubles or something like that, but chatzi nedan. Chatzi nedan. What's chatzi nedan? A half of the dowry. Whatever would be the dowry amount that would be provided for the kallah when she would enter into the marriage, so half of that amount would be payable as the knas by the chassid. Okay, that was standard knas. So the question is this only if they actually enter into the tanaim? Let's say that a couple got, and some say, by the way, as well, that the fact that this is done with Nehama Eder, that they sign the tanaim, like in a big l'chaim ceremony, they have a vort, and they sign the tanaim in front of everybody, that's equivalent. That's what some want to say. That's equivalent to Bezdin Chashuv. That's another explanation. That the idea that everyone does it, everyone's there. So it's kind of like as if you have a Bezdin Chashuv. Who is the Bezdin Chashuv? The Bezdin Chashuv is Klal Yisrael. The Bezdin Chashuv is West Rogers Park. The Bezdin Chashuv is the entire community. So the question is, what if the parties did not enter into Tanaim? But Moshe Feinstein says something very, very interesting. I think it's a little bit of a dasyuk. I don't think that this is the normative shita necessarily. Moshe Feinstein says that if you're going to be entering into Tanaim, so then the whole thing doesn't kick in until the moment of the Tanaim. But if he says there aren't going to be any Tanaim, which is generally the minhag nowadays. The minhag nowadays is that people don't sign any tanaim. There'd be this, like, this little ceremonial ritual document before the marriage itself, okay, before the wedding itself, at the catering hall, on the day of the wedding, when you have the chassan's tish, so then they sign this document in which they say, oh, everybody is lovey-dovey, and we did everything we were supposed to do, now we just can't wait to get married. So that document doesn't really have any halakhic import. Says Rav Moshe, that's not real tonight. That's not real tonight. That's just saying, okay, everything's done, now we're ready to go.
Because break the plane.
We'll talk about breaking the plane in a second. So that doesn't really have any halakhic import. So therefore, it says Rav Moshe, if that's the only tanaim you're going to do, that doesn't really count for anything. Then it's considered as if you're not really doing tanaim. If you're not really doing tanaim, so then the moment that the engagement takes place, or at least the moment that the engagement is officially announced, so that's when the chayim sets in. So it says the chayim would set in, basically even without tanaim, in a situation where you're not going to have tanaim. Now, others... So others say exactly like Ramosha. So the Nachla Shiva says, no, the reason why we don't do Tanayim nowadays, you know, and we wait and wait and wait, is precisely so that the Knas won't kick in. Not only is it so the Knas won't kick in, but some maintain that it all kind of goes together. That once you don't have the Knas anymore, you also don't have the Chayim anymore either. And therefore you don't have to worry so much about the Chayim. So says the Nachla Shiva, so that's why we're much more cool and laid back about the Tanayim nowadays, because we recognize that people may want to break off their engagement. Maybe a lot better for them to break off the engagement than to go into a marriage where they know they're going to have to get divorced and have to go through kashin agerishin, all of the stress and the hassle and the expense and the misery of a gerishin and of a get. So therefore, it's much better for everybody to do it this way. But the truth of the matter is that while I think that is somewhat mekubal when it comes to the enforcement of the knas, and there's a piskei din rabbanim, I think Rav Yossi was one of the dayanim, which basically says that given that there are different shitos, at the very least, if you don't have a written and signed document of tanaim where the parties have taken upon themselves this obligation of knas, a penalty, in the event of the breaking of the engagement, you really can't enforce the penalty in those cases. But nonetheless, people are still worried about the chayim. So the way in which you avoid the chayim is one solution, which is what the Hagos Maimonides says, Hagos Mordechai says, is to ensure that the way an engagement is broken up, if it really is appropriate to break up an engagement, is that the husband, the chassan and the kala together both mutually agree that they're okay with this, and that there is no clear party who was the one who imposed the broken engagement upon the other. But often that's not the case. Often it's very difficult to finesse that. So to be on the safe side, they say there should be an explicit waiver of any kind of continuing obligations that the parties have upon each other, and also a waiver of any claim regarding the elbow, regarding the embarrassment that one party suffered at the hands of the other. That there should be what's known as a shtar mechila, a shtar mechila. And this idea of the shtar mechila is very much based on this story of the chulda and the boar, that in order to prevent there being any kind of continuing metaphysical association with each other, a metaphysical obligation towards each other, you don't want anything happening to future born children, so you sign the shtar mechila. It was a little bit of a discussion about how extensive the shtar mechila should be. So somebody asked the Sri Deyesh, I'll jump ahead a little bit. Somebody asked the Sri Deyesh, you look at source 13 on page 3, what is the proper nusach for a broken engagement between a couple? This is Rabbi Lazarovsky who asked the Sri Deyesh of Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. And he said, that's a really good question. He said, I don't really have a nusach. He said, I don't have a nusach because there is the standard books that we have, the form legal documents in halakha don't have a standard form, shtar piturin, for a broken engagement. Now, I can understand this since the person who promulgated all the official forms was the Nachla Shiva. Nachla Shiva didn't seem to be terribly concerned about it, especially if you don't have, you know, tanaim, so maybe it goes hand in hand. It says, HaBesefa Nachla Shiva, HaMeibi Kol Nesklas HaShavas HaShonim, and maybe didn't know such Shtar Pitun. He doesn't bring it, and then he says, and others don't bring it as well. So he says, and the Ikka Minna, to write it, is in Poland, doesn't know what they have over there. So he said, you know what, this is one of these free-form documents. Oh, a free-form document. Every rabbi can do whatever they deem to be appropriate. And he said, I will give you a nusach. And he has a very simple, very straightforward nusach. Shitzav, shekalu, akhasan. Either one, they both, the minhag is that both parties, even if they're not the one who was responsible for the breaking of the engagement, they both write this letter to each other. Makla, akhasan. So the kala would write, she forgives the akhasan. Arabona, that she was embarrassed. Belev shalom, with a full and complete heart. Yiskim on the potro, and that she releases him. Mikochia from any obligation, veshibud sheba olam, or liability in the world. And it could be that one line document, and that is sufficient. So it's interesting, I spoke this past week, just a few days ago, I guess, We had a two-day conference in New York regarding Besdin issues. I think it was called Issues in Contemporary Besdin Practice was the title of the two-day conference. And various members of the Besdin of America got up and they spoke about Besdin procedure and protocols and different types of cases that arise. So one of the members of the Besdin administration staff said that one of the cases that they get a few of, you know, every single year, are these broken engagement cases. And one of the things that they always do is have, you know, try to resolve the issue if there are any outstanding claims, to resolve the claims. But at the end of the day, to make sure that they have both parties sign the Shtar Mechila form, and they even put, like, on a screen or something, on a PowerPoint projector, what the form looks like, and it's straight out of the Sri Deyesh. And I recognized it because I drafted the form when I was director of the Besdin of America, so I got it out of the Sri Deyesh. But there are others who have much more extensive forms that have, you know, like you would have a full waiver, release, indemnification, you know, type of a document that you would see in a legal document. And I wasn't so much in favor of the fuller form. We once had a case where the parties really wanted that much more extensive form because it looks much more official. And I was thinking, what's the whole point of a broken engagement? Why is it that you didn't have all these forms in the official the official document databases, you know, throughout the centuries? So I think that one of the major reasons is to show that this is not the same thing as a get, that this is not a couple that was actually married, that somebody shouldn't feel afterwards that this is like that when if they marry one of these parties, it's almost like a second marriage or something like that. That the marriage never happened, and they're no different from anybody else who has always been single. And if you make too much of a production over it, and you have too long a document, then it sends the wrong message. And I'm not making this up because this is basically what the Gemara in Yevamos Daf Kuf Zayin says with respect to miyun. There was one day that said that, you know, what's miyun? Miyun is if a woman has a little girl, has a rabbinical marriage, it's not binding according to Torah law, rabbinical marriage, her father had already died, and her mother and brother marry her off to somebody while she's a katana, and when she becomes 12 years old, she can decide that she doesn't want to really be married, and then retroactively it turns out that she was never really married, she can marry a kohen, no problem, because she's not a grusha, she's not really married. So, but you need some sort of a document to evidence that she did miyun. So according to one opinion, they put all these fancy lashonos, he says, lo be'inale, lo tzavisale, I don't want this guy, I don't desire this guy, I don't this, I don't that. And the other sheet in the Gemara says, what are you talking about? You put all these fancy lashonos, people are going to think it's like a get. Just say, on such and such day, this little girl did miyun in front of the following bezin. End of story. Nothing fancy, nothing that extensive. And that's how we pass the halacha. So my feeling is that the same thing should be true about broken engagements. And that's why there was never any quote-unquote official form. And when this is done, it should be as short and as terse a document as possible. So it's interesting because they mentioned at this conference that they had a case last year or so where I think the girl's family, I think that maybe it was the chassan who broke up the engagement, and the Kalas family was up in arms. And they had all kinds of claims, but when the release letter was the Shtar Mechila was suggested by the Besdin, so apparently the girl's mother was a big top shot like Wall Street lawyer, and she said, this isn't a good enough release. You gotta have a release, you gotta make it a real release. So he was like a full, you know, with all the bells and whistles, you know, the standard like English Wall Street legalese, you know, Wall Street firm release with, you know, 25 lines or so, and covering, you know, every single exigency from the beginning of the creation of the world until, you know, the coming of Mashiach, and basically had a much more extensive Russian. But it's all fine and good, whatever works. However, I do think that maybe this is the reason, this is the rationale as to why Chazal did not have an official form, and why I think that it's appropriate to have a shorter form. Okay, so that's all. It's now. I'm sorry?
Annulments.
Well, it's nothing to annul when all you have is an engagement. You mean that if you had a marriage,
right,
a kiddushin, that would then become annul. We had this discussion a little bit before when we had the shir about kiddushei taos. Said it's much easier halakhically to understand the concept of a kiddushin that becomes nullified. And sometimes we have that concept. The Meforshim speak about this in this context. They say, for example, in a kiddushin, it's very important that the ring be that the ring be returned. Okay, in a kiddushin, it's very important that the ring not be returned. That the ring not be returned. That if the kiddushin breaks up, so the kala should not return the ring that was given under the chuppah to the chassan. Why is that? Because people will think, the ring was returned, so they must have determined that the kiddushin was not really a good kiddushin altogether. That's why the ring was returned, and therefore the woman does not require a get, and it's going to create, and she's allowed to marry a kohen. It's going to create all kinds of misunderstandings and
mitzvot.
We're talking about the marriage, the kiddushin ring. We're talking about the kiddushin. I'm talking about there was no nisuin. There was no nisuin. Only a kiddushin. No nisuin took place.
Not the diamond ring that we do have.
We're not talking about the engagement ring. Yeah, we're talking about the kiddushin ring, the little ring.
The gold one. Okay, fine.
Gold ring, whatever. What's it called? The gold band that's given underneath the underneath the chuppah. So he says it's very important after kiddushin not to return that because people will think that this was a kiddushin tal situation. But if it was really a kiddushin tal situation, so then you return the ring. So the Mefarshim talk about how there is such a thing as kiddushin tal because people did this all the time. You find this in the Gemara. A man would say, "You are betrothed to me on condition that you give me $100 on condition of this, on condition of that." And the condition wouldn't be fulfilled, so there would be no kiddushin. However, when it comes to nisuin, as a general rule, we say that people waive any kiddushins, any conditions. Ain't tonight be nisuin. Once a couple is actually living together as husband and wife, because what is nisuin? It's bringing the kala into the domain of the husband. They're living together intimately as husband and wife. So then we assume that conditions are not so easily waived, and it's a big question mark about whether you could say that we annul a marriage after there's already been a nisuin. We spoke about specific, extreme, egregious situations, but we might say even that. But that's a very few and far between, and it's a sugya which is not, you know, necessarily a given premise, that it is not something which you would take for granted that a nisuin can necessarily be annulled altogether. But a kiddushin, yes, a kiddushin can be annulled, which is why we say that whenever there is a breakup of the marriage between the kiddushin and the nisuin, and it's not annulled, it's just that they broke it up between the kiddushin and nisuin, and a get does have to be given, it's very important that the kala keep the ring forever and never return that ring to the chassan. That's very, very important. Okay, but what about an engagement context? So let me first talk about the rare case where what they come in front of the Beis Din to discuss is, can this engagement be broken altogether? Because people are worried a little bit about chayrim. Let's say you hold like Rav Moshe, that there's an automatic chayrim if you're not going to be doing tanaim. Or let's say that they had the temerity to have a tanaim and a bort where they actually signed the tanaim document that had kenas. Anybody ever see that? Anybody ever be at a bort where they actually signed such a document where people took upon themselves kenasos and things of that variety? Absolutely. So let's say something like that happened. So are you completely stuck? Or are there valid reasons to get out of it? So the Chassam Sofer had a case where his son, the Chassam Sofer gave permission to his son to break off an engagement because he discovered shortly before the marriage was supposed to take place that the woman went to a theater on the night of a Seder B'Tavis. Can you imagine? So the Kala actually frequented a theater on, not only did she frequent a theater, but she did on the night of a Seder B'Tavis. It was grounds for breaking up. If a person shows that they don't have the requisite level of mitzvah observance, so that could be grounds for breaking up an engagement. Or they speak about yuxin cases where, interesting cases where there will be like tremendous embarrassment to the family that the Kala's brother goes off and converts to Christianity or something, or there's like some scandal in the family where it'd be like a yichus issue. They say that could potentially be grounds as well. Or they speak about health issues. There's a medical issue, some very serious medical issue. So we had this case, a very fascinating case, that the couple did genetic testing. Now, we strongly encourage that every single couple, before they get married, they should do genetic testing to make sure that they're not going to be carriers together of Tay-Sachs or cystic fibrosis or things of that variety. And really, you should do the testing before the engagement. That's probably a good idea, right? But in this case, they didn't. They decided to do the testing after the engagement. They did the testing after the engagement. It turned out that they were both Tay-Sachs carriers, and therefore, that created a completely untenable situation. So the cousin's family didn't know, you know, exactly what to do. They asked the Shaila, and the Rav, who they asked the Shaila of, said, I think you should break off the engagement. So they broke off the engagement, and the Kala's family brought an action in the Beis Din for specific performance. They said, hey, come on, she found this nice boy, she agreed to marry him, he has to go do it and marry her. Okay, this is it. We want this guy. We want this guy. We still want him. He broke off the engagement, we still want him. So it was the question. So the Beis Din paskin that there is no obligation under those circumstances for the chassan to continue to honor his word when there's a high probability that they would be thrusting themselves into this tremendously tragic situation of having children with Tay-Sachs, where, you know, the children would end up, you know, dying, God forbid. So the argument from the Kala's side was, but they can do IVF. Nowadays you can do IVF, and then you could check, and then you could test the fetuses to make sure, you know, that you do pre-genetic screening, what's the word for that, and make sure that the fetuses don't have Tay-Sachs, and only then implant the fetus into the womb. Pre-implantation, you know, genetic testing. So, the Beis Din paskin, that it's not a good idea to lechatchila thrust people into a marriage situation where that's the only way in which it's viable for them to have children, if it's possible for them to have children otherwise in the normal course, by just marrying other people. So we did have, you know, that particular situation, very, very fascinating. But the normal type of case that comes to Beis Din is where, after the broken engagement, the party who had the engagement broken and then is not really so interested in marrying the other party anymore, and it's not going to be invoking specific performance. Probably not. However, they might sometimes be looking for monetary damages. Now, the monetary damages take one of four different forms, and I'll quickly go through it in our remaining time, God willing. Okay? One, we already went through, right? One type of monetary damage is the knas, the payment of the knas. Is the knas payable or not? Does the one who had the engagement broken on them, the offended party, the victim of the broken engagement, so to speak, do they have the right to insist upon payment of the knas either? If there was no knas, that we said, the piske din rabbanim paskin, if there was no document with a knas signed, so then that's a mosimei chaveri or lavaraya, we're not going to impose the knas. But let's say that they did sign such a document. So are we going to impose the knas or not? So, api pashtus, if they did sign the document imposing the knas, so then a Beis Din would have to look for... they would have to look at whether the engagement was broken for cause or not. They have to see, was one of these categories satisfied that the one who broke up the engagement and a valid reason to break up the engagement? But otherwise, then, mistama, the psak would be that the knas should be payable on some level. Or if the psak, the knas is chatzi nedan, a half of the dowry, they'd have to, like, figure out, they'd have to assess, you know, if the dowry hadn't been paid yet, or if it hadn't been assessed in the document, they'd have to figure out what would be a reasonable assessment of the chatzi nedan. So interestingly enough, Moshe Feinstein had such a case. Moshe Feinstein had a case, as you look at source 16. Source 16, Minyan Kal Shibola Shidduch, is the case where there's the Kala who broke up the engagement, and the chassan is looking for payment of the knas. So the chassan made a number of different claims. He said, after they made the sudas tonight, and if they made a sudas tanaim, we're presuming they were tanaim of some sort, and they sent hazmanos, they already sent invitations, right? I mean, you said, you've been in cases where, like, you know, after the upper for the engagement was broken up. Not unusual either that after the sending of the invitations, that, you know, creates an additional hurdle, right? Siva Kala Lis Katin. Kala said, no do, I am not marrying this guy, forget it. Well, Viva Shidduch, and they broke off the engagement. Hachasan, Tavashi Tashan, Rodimeos Asab. So he wanted all of his expenses. We'll get to that in a second. But what I want to focus upon right here is ubosto. He wanted paid his embarrassment. What's ubosto? Bosto is the knas. That's what it is. That's what the knas should be. So he says that if you take a jump about four lines until the last sentence of this paragraph, Be'atamu, so he said, so Ramoshe required the Kala to pay $1,000 for the knas. $1,000 for the knas. So, and this is a long time ago. This is Tavshin Chav Beis. So this is 57 years ago when $1,000 was worth, what would be the equivalent of today's value of what $1,000 was worth 57 years ago? Anybody want to venture, like, just a wild guess? I mean, I know I did myself, but, you know, what? No, it was $1,000 57 years ago, so it would probably be worth like $10,000 today. In other words, if Moshe said 57 years ago, okay, that the Kala had to, this is 1962 or something, that the Kala would have to pay $1,000, so $1,000 in 1962 dollars, right, would be in 2019 dollars, probably at least $10,000. This is a very sizable sum that Ramosha required to be paid. Because he says that the wedding feast, that the cost of the wedding feast is basically the modern-day equivalent of the nedunya, of the dowry. That's what Moshe says. I'm just saying. Kimin should ask himself because the chassan has to pay the suda. The Kala's father is paying the suda because, as we all know, The Kalas are the ones, right? The Kalas family pays for the wedding. The Chassan's family pays for nothing except what flops, you know? Comes out to 50-50, but okay. And suddenly, Ramosh is working with the assumption that the Kalas father is paying for everything. It was a Chassan and Levay Nodim, Oder Luban Ayam Kalpayim Dollar, and he said, this is 57 years ago. That a wedding cost about $20,000, right? So, Bari, Chatzin Adunya, the Knas, and therefore, since we say Chatzin Adan is the Knas, so it will come out to $10,000. But whatever, you know, however you calculate, whatever the Adunya is nowadays, it's interesting that even then, I mean, I'm sorry, what did he say that he said $1,000, excuse me, Kalav, not $20,000. He said in those days, the wedding fees cost, nowadays, of course, you know, more in that vicinity, maybe more than that, but in Lakewood, you can get away with something maybe closer to $20,000. But he said in those days, the wedding fees cost $2,000, and therefore the Chassid Adan should be $1,000.
And the Beis Din can do a Knas nowadays?
Yes, they can do a Knas. If it's not a Knas which is sort of officially mandated by the Torah, but it's a Knas which is created, you know, by Chazal for special situations, so then, yes, such a Knas would be enforceable. So that's in terms of the Knas. So we see that as recently as 57 years ago, Ramosha was still enforcing, you know, a Knas, and here it's not that, I don't know, you don't get the sense. Ramosha speaks about Sugas tonight, you don't get the sense, this is consistent with Ramosha, it's consistent with Ramosha's Shita, that there was necessarily a Tanaim document, but because of the fact that, you know, there was a commitment, so Moshe felt that the Chatzin Nidan figure, which was the standard figure for a Knas, was the amount that should be payable in this case. Okay, now, next category, Matanos, gifts. Okay, gifts. So what? This is what the Gemara in Baba Basra, the Daf Kuf Mem Vav, that source of 4 and 5, speaks about as the Sivlonos, right? Sivlonos, that a Chassan and Kala would get engaged, and the Chassan would send gifts, or send nice things. Some of it would be food, Ragaloch. Some of it would be nice clothes for the Kala. Some of it could be jewelry, a nice necklace, a pearl necklace for the Kala. And some of it just might be, he'll give her a nice watch, give her various objects. Some of the objects would be permanent objects, like the jewelry and accessories and things of that sort. And some of it would be things that would wither away, like the clothes or food, or maybe even some money that she would spend. So with respect to the things that don't wither away, the permanent things, like the takshitin, so the halakha is that it doesn't matter. What the Gemara indicates, what Shulchan Aruch also in Siman Nun and Evan Ezer indicates as well, with respect to the things that don't wither away, when the engagement gets broken up, it doesn't matter who breaks off the engagement, you return the gifts. You return the gifts! End of story! That the engagement ring and the chassan gives the kala the engagement ring, she returns the engagement ring. Even if he's the one who broke off the engagement, she doesn't get to keep the engagement ring. The engagement ring goes back. She gave him a nice watch, he returns the nice watch. Whatever it is he gave, whatever jewelry he gave her, all of these different things we assume were only given in anticipation of marriage. If he gave her a gift before the engagement, oh, that's a different story. Unless he gave it to her, he said, tonight, I'm only giving you this gift in the event that eventually, a couple of months from now, we're going to get engaged. Okay, it's a different story. But if he says nothing, he gives her a comic book, whatever, and during this second or third date, she gets to keep it, no matter what. She gets to keep it because it's understood that nobody necessarily is counting on getting married at that point in time. They're only counting on getting married from the point of engagement and onward. There's another good reason, though, besides this, why it's important for the college to return the engagement ring to the chassan, and that's to show that there was no marriage. That unlike a marriage situation where she would hold on to the gift forever because the marriage did take place, and the marriage didn't take place, that's another very good reason why it's important for the engagement ring davka to be returned under these circumstances. So all of the gifts that are still extant, that don't wither or wear away, all of those things get returned regardless of who broke off the engagement. That's category number two. Then we have category number three, which is the most complicated category, and that's the category of items that wither away. And this is the situation that was spoken about in the Gemara, that's spoken about in the Rishonim, where there are, for example, food items that the Chassan's Ragloch. The Chassan sends over to the Kala the Ragloch. The Ragloch are not going to last forever, okay? Even with lots and lots of preservatives, they're not going to last, you know, for 30 years or so. So the Ragloch wears away, or there might be certain clothing items that will just wear away over time. So here, there seems to be a distinction regarding who is breaking off the engagement. Who's breaking off the engagement? That if it is the Chassan, and again, the context in which this is spoken about in the Gemara is the context of a Chassan and Kala who already have Erisin, and this is taking place between the Erisin and the Nisuin. However, as the Shulchan Aruch says, and as the Aruch HaShulchan speaks about, and others, these laws basically effectively translate into the modern-day situation of a broken engagement between the Shidduchin and the Erusin. There's no reason to differentiate. There's a Ramah that indicates maybe we'll differentiate a little bit, but not significantly, if this takes place, if the breakup takes place between the Shidduchin and the Erusin. Okay, so so in this case, if the Chassan sends the food and then he breaks off the engagement, so we say, well, it depends. If he ate and, well, according to one Shita, if he ate and he enjoyed the food, this is according to the Shita of the Torah, if he ate and he enjoyed the food, so then he doesn't get anything back. If he didn't eat and enjoy the food, so then he gets it back, but with a one-third discount. So we assume that there's a one-third discount because these are things that wear away, and food doesn't last forever, so maybe it was worth $100 when he gave it, but he should only get $66 back. Okay, that's sort of the way that it breaks out. And a court breaks that, and according to the Rambam, the Rambam says, well, it depends on whether they're extant or not. That if, again, the person, the chassan, broke it off, and now he wants his stuff back, and it's not extant, so he doesn't get it back. If it's still extant, he gets it back. If it's the kala who broke it off, then he gets everything back. So that's the basic breakdown between the different cases. And the Aruch HaShulchan says that nowadays we generally assume that if a party was responsible for breaking it up, they don't get anything back. If it's not extant anymore, and you're the one who broke it up, so they have to pay you back something? Are you kidding me? Since nobody really understands that halakha, doesn't really explain how you get out of whatever makoros, leads to that halakha. Since nobody really gets that halakha, so therefore none of that, goes back. But if the party the party that broke it up certainly has to return everything. That's what the halakha says. So turn to source number 8. Right? Okay. Go about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines down in source 8 in the Shulchan Aruch. Chatzar Hiba, if she's the one, he gave her some food or things that expire or that wear out. Chosir HaKod, and everything gets a return. But when we say everything returns, it still gets returned with the discount. You still have the one-third discount that is applied because of the fact that there is a difference in the value between the time that it was given and the time that it's going to be paid back. So there still is that discounting of one-third. Okay, so that is with respect to category number 3. And again, generally speaking, who's making the claim? I got to tell you, in the cases that come to Beis Din, the one who broke off the engagement is generally not making the claim. The only time the one who broke off the engagement is making the claim is if let's say the chassan broke off the engagement and he didn't get his engagement ring back. So then he might make that claim. He's not making a claim of, I sent her a cake for Shabbos and that would cost me $10 and now I want $6.67. That doesn't happen. So you have to worry about that. What happens is in the other direction, that the person who, that if he, spent money, and then she broke off the engagement, so he might be making a claim, but generally speaking, the claim will be limited to either, the knas, the boshes, which as we said is debatable nowadays, whether it's collectible at all, the return of the matanos, generally not those things that are expendable. Now, if it was money, he gave money, so you say money also gets discounted at one-third less, so you could say maybe that. If you said, I gave her $1,000 of spending money and I want $660 back, so because she broke off the engagement, okay, I can hear that. But people are not generally giving just cash to their chassan and kala so much. I don't see that happen so much. So the next most relevant category is really category number 4. What's category number 4? Category number 4 is the famous machlokas mamar and raivin. This is, you can find it in source 6. Source 6, Rambam Hilchos Zechiyah Matan Perek Vav Halacha Chof Dalet, talks about a situation where it was the minhag that between the Erusin and the Nisuin, the Chassan would make a big party! You know, they make engagement parties, right? Make a big party, only it wasn't an engagement party, it was an Erusin party. We can't even relate to this because we don't have this period between Erusin and Nisuin. Make a big Erusin party, then after he expends all this money, this isn't food that he's sending in the college. He's making a big party. He's inviting lots of people. He's spending a lot of money. He invites, he hires a band. He has flower arrangements. I mean, it's like an expensive proposition. Some of these, engagement parties can be very expensive propositions if you go to them. And he spends a lot of money on this party, and then she backs out. It's sort of weird, the lashon of the Rambam, if she backs out, she still needs to get. But it's like assume, yeah, of course she'll get a get. But she backs out between the Erisin and the Nisuin. So says the Rambam, she has to pay him. Mishalem is a cause. She already gobbled the Abi Mamun. She caused him because he thought he's making this party because he's going to get married to her. And then she backed out. So therefore, she has to reimburse him for everything. She has to reimburse him for everything. So says the Ravid, what is this reimbursement business? This isn't something that he's giving her. This is just an expense that he is incurring. It's like a person, and nowadays it would be as analogous to a person planning the wedding, and they hire the caterer, they reserve the wedding hall, they do all of these things. You're not giving anything to the other person. You're just incurring these expenses in anticipation of marriage. Says the Ravid, that's groma. That's like indirect. That's just an indirect causation of a person losing money. It's similar to the case where you go to your local farm and your local botanist, I don't know, and you buy seeds to plant in the ground. Zeroni gina. And you seeds to plant in your garden. And it turns out the seeds don't catch. The seeds were lousy seeds. So you spent a lot of money digging away in your garden and, you know, you spent hours of work in terms of your expenses as you're digging your garden and preparing your garden and all that. And the seeds don't sprout. So what are you entitled to be reimbursed for? What's the halacha? Even the Rambam paskens this way. What do you get reimbursed for? All of your hotzos, all of the expenses that went into digging your ground, or just you get the expense of the seeds back. All you get is the expense of the seeds back. So ask the Ravid, why should this be any different? And therefore, the person who made all these expenditures does not get any money back. This is similar to like the heart bomb statute that exists in many states. In many, many states, you have a heart bomb statute. I have it for New York in Source 14, the case of Bruno versus Guerra, where the heart bomb statute says that we abolish all causes of action to recover damages for breach of contract to marry, which includes the expenditure of various expenses in anticipation of the marriage. Obviously, you're entitled to get your gifts back, okay? Even the heart bomb statute is not obliterating that. But it means that you can't say, oh, I spent $10,000 in anticipation of the marriage. Oh, I hired a caterer, a whore, all that. No, you don't get your money back from the other side, even if you break off the engagement. That's what the heart bomb statute says. And that's consistent with the Ravid Shita. But how does the Rambam account for the Ravid's Kasha? So there are different ways. You could say, no, the case of Zeruna Gina, the person is planting for their own benefit. They're going through all the hotels for their own benefit. But when you're making an engagement party, you're not doing it for your own benefit per se. You're also doing it for the other person. Or you could say, in Zeruna Gina, the person who sold you the seeds didn't tell you to go and plant the seeds. However, in this particular case, it's as if, this is what the box says, it's as if the Kala is saying to the chassan, make me the Suda like everybody else makes the Suda. I want you to make the Suda too. So you have to figure out, is the minute nowadays that, you know, if you have an engaged couple and somebody spends a lot of money on an engagement party, so you could say, is that the minog? That's as if the kala is saying to the chassan, I want you to spend the money because this is what everybody does. So then there would be more of an argument in favor of the Rambam's opinion. If it's not what everybody does, so then you could say more of an argument in favor of the Rambam's opinion. Or if the chassan is doing it because he really, really is into it and he's doing it because he's really enjoying it, so then also there would be more an argument for the Rambam's opinion. If he's doing it because to satisfy his kala, more an argument for the Rambam's opinion. So you have to look at maybe the facts, you know, in every single case. The Shulchan Aruch paskens like the Rambam, the Vilna Gaon says, don't forget the Ravid. So you see, the Vilna Gaon resurrects the Ravid like it's something to be considered la halacha. So the Bez and the Beis Shmuel says that just like we have a 1/3 discount with respect to items that wear away, so with respect to all of these expenses that were invested into the wedding, he throws in that there should be a 1/3 discount about this as well. And others say, we don't really understand why there should be a 1/3 discount. But he says, yeah, once we're discounting, let's throw in a 1/3 discount, you know, for these expenses as well. So when the cases come to the Bez, then what do? So we try to do what the Aruch HaShulchan says. You take a look at the Aruch HaShulchan in Source 7. Aruch HaShulchan says that we basically pass like the Rambam. He says, second line, middle of the line, that you have to, all the expenses have to be reimbursed. But according to the Ravid, you would not collect all of that. So you think that's the minhag pashut b'chol bati adin. We pass like the Rambam, that technically speaking, the one who had the engagement, the one who broke off the engagement is responsible to pay the expenses that were incurred by the other person in anticipation of marriage. But he says, what happens most of the time? We don't want dina tov over broken engagements. We have enough dina tov over divorces. So I think, like, you know, it is al rishonim and mitzdarim. When it comes to broken engagements, we really don't want to make a federal case out of it for the reason that I said at the beginning. We don't want it to be viewed as such a big deal that, you know, the next time around the person's like going for a second marriage. You want it to be like nothing really happened. It's like people broke up or broke, you know, they broke up their relationship after 5-6 dates. It shouldn't be treated any differently to traumatize people for life. So therefore, we strongly encourage parties to make up pshara. Just settle, work it out, maybe split things 50-50, give, like, you know, a token amount, just work things out in a way in which it should be b'shalom or shalva. Piskei Koshin says something very similar. Take a look at the Piskei Koshin, source 12, going over to page, the top of page 3. He said that l'maisa v'derech klal, 3 lines from the bottom of the Piskei Koshin, l'maisa v'derech klal misra'atzim v'chakak l'mchol zeh l'zeh, after they sign a shtam mechila, parties are generally willing to forgive each other. Sometimes they'll take a little bit of money. If they're not able to work things out amongst themselves, let them go to a mediator, a wise man, who will mediate a settlement between them. So then nobody should feel be under a chayrim, that people should be comfortable writing a shtam mechila to each other, that it should all be worked out as amicably and as pleasantly as possible, without or the entire spectacle of having a full-fledged din Torah. So that's very much what we try to do in these types of situations. But l'maisa, what we see is that halacha does recognize a certain amount of accountability, a certain amount of responsibility on the part of a person who breaks off an engagement. At the same time, we try to structure things in such a way that we allow parties to break off an engagement and not feel that they have to go into a marriage when they know that it's going to lead to divorce. When there is a broken engagement, any gifts that parties have should be returned to each other. And as far as other expenses that could have been incurred, so every single case has to be examined separately in terms of its own merits. But at the end of the day, there's a strong encouragement for the parties to reach a settlement by themselves, or for the bezdin to facilitate a settlement between the parties so that they can move on with their lives and get married to somebody else. B'shalom, b'shalva, u'b'simcha.
Of those categories, 4 categories, is there a category that says, I don't love him. It turns out we dated, and I want to break off
yes,
the engagement.
Yes, so the Nachlas Tzvi.
Is love considered
the Nachlas Tzvi, but Tzvi, a Felder.
Gedalia Felder.
Gedalia Felder, Paskin, then Moisolai. If a woman comes to the conclusion when she says this man is mamish repugnant, even if we don't view that as legitimate enough to compel a get, which is the machlokas we showed him, once a car party is already married, but for breaking off an engagement, he said that that's considered to be legitimate and that there would be no chayim in such a situation.
Okay. What is the chamos? If you're not having... No,